All right, it is 9:02. We're going to get started, and hopefully nobody had any serious technological problems in getting in. If you do, when we take this off of mute, then let us know, and certainly we'll look into it. I apologize in advance if anybody did have those questions. All right, so there's plenty, as always, to report on today. I want to start off with Congress, and not necessarily with the Michael Cohen hearing today, but and a statute or a proposed statute which has been reintroduced into Congress, and it's been the subject of a lot of discussion, and we'll have to wait and see what happens with it, but it's called the Paycheck Fairness Act. This was introduced into the Congress on January the 30th. It's been introduced before, namely in the Obama administration, but never got much traction. So this is H.R. 7, for those of you who have a technical bent, again, called the Paycheck Fairness Act. The introduction of the act states that women have entered the workforce in record numbers over the past 50 years. Despite the enactment of the Equal Pay Act of 1963, many women continue to earn significantly lower pay than men for equal work. These pay disparities exist in both the private and governmental sectors. In many instances, the pay disparities can only be due to continued intentional discrimination or the lingering effects of past discrimination. So, the major elements of this proposed legislation are the following. One, it would enact a wage history ban. In other words, employers, as is the case in some states now, would be prohibited from requesting or relying on the wage history of a prospective employee. So the theory is that if an employer is allowed to ask this kind of question on an application or a job interview, it would perpetuate the effects of past wage discrimination. Two, an employer would have to show under this statute that a disparity in pay between males and females was due to a bona fide factor other than sex, and that the factor, one, was not based upon or derived from a sex-based differential in compensation, two, was job-related, three, was consistent with business necessity, and four, accounts for the entire differential in compensation. In a sort of a draconian kind of measure, there would be penalties for violations of this statute, including punitive damages if employers were found to act with malice or reckless indifference. Just yesterday, the House Labor Committee, so this was yesterday, February the 26th, cleared this proposal, setting up a floor vote in Congress on this particular statute. So what happened was in the committee, they voted along party lines 27 to 19 to send it to the House floor. Who knows, really, what will happen with this statute? I would think, given the composition of Congress, that it or the House of Representatives, that it's likely that this may pass in the House of Representatives. When it gets to the Senate, I doubt that it would pass. But I do think it's indicative of a trend in many cases involving state statutes, at least with part of this particular statute, that it may become law down the road. And certainly in 2020, if there were a Democratic president and a Democratic Senate, there would be a good chance that something like this would pass, at least in this iteration or in some other iteration. There's been great emphasis both at the Department of Labor and at the Equal Employment Opportunity Commission on pay disparities between females and males. And I think the takeaway for you all is that as you do analysis of your own pay structure, that you take a look at whether or not you have gender gaps with regard to pay for females as opposed to males, and if there are such gaps, that you try and ascertain whether there are valid bona fide reasons for that, or if you need to do some adjustments along the way. Because certainly the Equal Employment Opportunity Commission and the Department of Labor, irrespective of whether this statute gets passed or not, are looking at these kinds of disparities. And those of you who have government contracts and are governed by the OFCCP need to pay particular attention to this, either because you may be subject to audit as a result of a complaint by female or a random audit by the OFCCP. So a word to the wise, take a look at your salary structure, your pay grades, and make sure that if there are gender gaps, that it's defensible as opposed to something that just has been a historical carryover from one year to another. I think you need to pay particular attention to that. Another aspect sort of in the government realm that I wanted to point out is that we've talked before about the Department of Labor's rule or proposed rule on the amendment having to do with the white-collar exemptions. So there's been a lot written recently as to when this may drop. Again, I think I've mentioned this in prior telebriefs. I would think sometime in 2019 we will have a new proposed rule by the Department of Labor. There's been some talk about the fact that in addition to a salary adjustment, remember the old salary exempt level was about $24,000 under the Obama proposal. It was completely doubled to about $47,000, and my own prediction has been between $30,000 and $35,000 as to where this will wind up. But there's also been some talk in sort of professional circles about whether or not there will be a further adjustment depending on the particular exemption. So, you know, it would be a sophisticated division between the administrative exemption, the professional exemption, and the executive exemption as to whether there may be different salary levels for each of those exemptions. I doubt that will happen. That's a pretty high level of sophistication. There's also been some talk about whether or not there will be automatic COLA increases to these salary exemptions along the way. I don't think that's going to happen either. I think there's been enough internal dissension within the ranks of the Department of Labor about how to go about enacting this proposed rule. And I, just from a prediction standpoint, I do think what's going to happen is that you'll have one salary level without a COLA increase somewhere between $30,000 and $35,000. So stay tuned for that. I do think we're headed into a period sometime in the second quarter when this proposed rule will drop. And I also think that you will have an enacted rule prior to the 2020 presidential campaign. So stay tuned, and of course, I'll keep you updated on that. Wanted to pay some attention to some very recent cases having to do with harassment, discrimination, et cetera, because I do think they have some practical import for you all out there as professionals. So in a recent case decided by the Fourth Circuit, this was on February the 8th. Now, the Fourth Circuit includes Maryland, North Carolina, South Carolina, Virginia, and West Virginia. This was a case officially titled Parker versus REEMA, R-E-E-M-A, Consulting Services, again, decided a couple weeks ago. The Fourth Circuit dealt with a situation where an employee by the name of Evangeline Parker was working at this company, REEMA Consulting, as a clerk at its warehouse facility. She had a pretty successful career, being promoted 6 times, and she eventually wound up as an assistant operations of the manager of the facility in March of 2016. However, 2 weeks after her last promotion, the male employees in the facility began circulating rumors, which were false, that she had obtained her position because of a sexual relationship with a high-ranking male manager. These rumors continued to spread, and particularly were announced or repeated at a group meeting by a supervisory employee. Now, what happened was she complained to HR about these rumors, and eventually, not too long after complaining, at least for what the company says was a legitimate reason, she was terminated. But as you might imagine, she filed a complaint, which wound up in federal court, asserting rights under Title VII, saying that she had been the victim of sexual harassment and retaliation under Title VII. Now, when it got to federal court, the court granted the employer's motion to dismiss and said that the rumor was not gender-based and found that there was not retaliation as a matter of law. Her attorney appealed to the Fourth Circuit. Now, the Fourth Circuit reversed and significantly said the sex-based nature of the rumor and its effects plausibly invokes a deeply rooted perception, one that unfortunately still persists, that generally women, not men, use sex to achieve success. And with this double standard, women, but not men, are susceptible to being labeled as sluts or worse, prostitutes selling their bodies for gain. So that the court also noted that a male allegedly started the rumor and that all the people who spread the rumors were males. And they went on to say that in this circuit, the Fourth Circuit, a plaintiff establishes a hostile work environment because of sex where that plaintiff alleges that the conduct was unwelcome, that it was based on the employee's sex, that it was sufficiently severe or pervasive to alter the conditions of employment and create an abusive atmosphere, and was on some basis imputable to the employer. The Fourth Circuit concluded that there was enough of an allegation here that it was severe or pervasive based on the fact that these rumors were continuously spread over a two-month period. It's a pretty novel approach. There are many other circuits that have found that the spreading of such rumors will not amount to a hostile work environment, but in the Fourth Circuit, and that's the circuit that we all face particular cases here. In the Fourth Circuit, the spreading of those rumors are found to be at least enough to create a prima facie case of hostile work environment. And I say it as a matter of caution, as a matter of training for you all out there, that I think it's worth noting that you need to stress in your training with supervisors and managers that at least in the Fourth Circuit, it is sufficient to create a hostile work environment for rumors based on sex to be disseminated and communicated within the workplace. So I think that those of you who are out there and who are planning on conducting training during 2019 should include this particular example in that training and make sure that your supervisors and managers understand that the dissemination of rumors, and they may just be that, rumors, may be enough to create a hostile work environment, at least within this particular circuit. Now, another case along those same lines, just on February the 20th, so just a week ago, the Seventh Circuit, which is not our circuit, was looking at a case called Gates versus Board of Education of the City of Chicago. And in this particular case, the plaintiff, Fred Gates, he was an African-American building engineer, alleged that on three separate occasions within a two-year period of time, his direct supervisor made him the butt of a joke in which the supervisor called Gates the N-word, that there was another instance when the supervisor threatened to write up Gates's, in quotes, black ass, close quotes. And on a third occasion, the supervisor's comment was referencing, in quotes, you people, close quotes, and again using the N-word. Gates asserted in the district court, the trial court, federal trial court, that those interactions spread out as they were over a two-year period constituted a hostile work environment under Title VII. The district court dismissed the claim of Gates on summary judgment, contending that he faced a high bar, as the workplace that is actionable is one that is, in quotes, hellish, close quotes. Gates appealed to the Seventh Circuit, and the Seventh Circuit reversed, concluding that as a matter of law, a jury could have found that the supervisory conduct alleged in Gates' testimony was sufficiently severe or pervasive to constitute a hostile work environment. Now, I think that the takeaway from that case is that, in my belief, as an outgrowth of the Me Too movement, what we're seeing, I think, nationally, is that there's much more sensitivity in the federal circuits with regard to what constitutes severe or pervasive conduct sufficient to create a hostile work environment. We know that there is a bifurcated standard under Title VII, so something can be a severe act, and a severe act may be something egregious, which would constitute actionable hostile work environment. So, for instance, if you had an employee who came in one day, an African-American employee came in one day, and there was a picture and an actual noose sitting on that employee's desk, that, without a doubt, would be deemed sufficiently severe in itself, sufficiently egregious, to create a hostile work environment. Or, over a period of time, if there's a continuous course of misconduct on the part of either a co-employee or a supervisory employee, there's much more likeliness, it seems to me, on the part of federal district courts, and particularly federal appeals courts, to call something a hostile work environment where in the past it may not have passed muster. And I do believe that this is a consequence and a follow-up to the outgrowth of the Me Too movement. Again, as a matter of training, with your supervisors, managers, and rank-and-file employees, I think that you need to stress that what may have passed muster years ago as not sufficiently pervasive or not sufficiently egregious to constitute a hostile work environment may not pass muster now. And I think that that's noteworthy as you conduct ongoing training of your managerial and supervisory staff. So there may be acts that occur in the workplace which even a few years ago may not have been viewed as actionable, which today are viewed as actionable, and I think that you need to recognize that in your formal policies on workplace harassment and your training as well. In the realm of disability, I would point out a story that appeared in the Seattle Times on February the 21st. It is entitled Fired Amazon Employee with Crohn's Disease Files Lawsuit Over Lack of Bathroom Access. This is a story by a reporter named Benjamin Romano, who reports an employee in an Amazon call center in Kentucky asked managers for flexibility in the company's break schedule to accommodate bathroom needs stemming from his Crohn's disease, a painful, chronic, and unpredictable inflammatory bowel condition. But instead, a supervisor accused him of stealing time, and he was fired, he alleges, in a lawsuit against the company, charging discrimination under the Americans with Disability Act and Kentucky law. The ADA complaint, he says, filed last week, which would have been a little more than a week ago, in the United States District Court in Lexington, Kentucky, spells out a strict and limited break schedule and an Amazon customer service center in the suburb of Winchester that employs some 900 people, excuse me. He goes on to say that the employee, Nicholas Stover, needed to use the bathroom more frequently than the schedule allowed as a result of his disease. He asked for a flexible schedule to be moved closer to the bathroom, but he was denied those accommodations, he alleges, in the lawsuit. Amazon declined comment on the issue because it was pending litigation. Now, it's noteworthy that when Mr. Stover disclosed his disease to Amazon when he applied for the job, and during training at the company's customer service call center in Winchester. So he again reiterated, at least according to the lawsuit, the need to either have more frequent breaks or to have his office closer to the bathroom because of his Crohn's disease. Significantly, I want to emphasize, this is his complaint. These are bare allegations without a lot of fill-in, and certainly without a response to the lawsuit filed by Amazon. But I think that it's noteworthy and it's indicative of the fact that in today's day and age, frequently we deal as employers with requests for accommodations by an employees or applicants for jobs. Assuming, just for the second, that Mr. Stover's complaint has merit in that Amazon refused to either move his office closer to the bathroom or to provide more frequent breaks. The question is, was his request a request for a reasonable accommodation, or would it have imposed an undue burden on Amazon as an employer? We can generally assume in today's day and age that most conditions that are articulated or specified by employees or candidates for employment today are going to be considered to be a covered disability under the ADA or the ADA Amendments Act. So the question usually revolves around, is the request a reasonable one? Is the accommodation requested by the employee a reasonable one? And that takes into account, you know, what are the operational impacts of the request? What are the costs? And you have to really consider these on a case-by-case basis. It doesn't seem to me on the face of this that the request would have been a unusual or an unreasonable request, but we just don't know the facts of the particular case. And certainly as the case goes on and Amazon answers the lawsuit, we'll find out what the defense of Amazon is. But those of you out there who regularly deal with disabilities or a request for an accommodation, have to take a look at these on a case-by-case basis as opposed to some general rules that you follow in deciding whether a request for an accommodation is reasonable. It really is a multi-factor analysis, and you really have to engage in an interactive dialogue with the person who's making the request and to document the results of that interactive dialogue and the decision whether to grant the request as made or perhaps to modify the request. So we are in an era when these cases are very prevalent, and I think it's incumbent upon all of you to be cognizant of employees or candidates for employment who are making these requests and to document the interactive dialogue and discussion that you may have with the individual as to the reasonableness of the request and whether you can grant it or whether really there is some undue burden, whether there's a huge expense or some real operational impediment that's posed by the request. Okay, those are the developments for the day. Casey, can you take this off of mute? All right, are we off of mute, Casey?
Yes, you should be good to go now.
Okay. All right. As always, I invite any questions or comments from anybody.
It'd probably be more relevant for him, like, even to get in front of people.
I'm sorry, I didn't hear it. You might be on a speakerphone. Could you just repeat that?
But anyway, it's just a suggestion.
I'm sorry, I didn't hear the comment or the suggestion. Any questions from anybody?
Hi, my name is Lauren Burke. I'm the CTO of a small woman-owned business. This is my first time on the call. Thank you very much. This has been very informative. I actually have a service dog, so I'm very well read on a lot of ADA laws. However, I have a unique question for you. There was a client that I placed into a job, and he has been calling me after hiring this person about his body or odor. And from my understanding from my employment attorney, there's a very fine line on what can be considered a medical condition and what's considered, not being, well kept, let's just say, in terms of hygiene. What is your experience, or do you have any of hearing of anything like that
I have dealt with that, and sometimes there is a fine line because there are some medical conditions, obviously, that may impact on an employer's policy having to do with reasonable grooming and hygiene standards. And an employer always has the right to establish reasonable hygiene and grooming standards. And if the employee's medical condition, even assuming that it is a medical condition, is interfering with the comfort, let's say, or the ability of other employees to function normally and to be able to perform their normally assigned duties, then an employer does have a right to mandate that that employee either take care of that medical condition so that the impact doesn't have a negative influence on other employees, or to actually be separated in some way where it doesn't have an impact on other employees. The simple answer to your question, and it's not a, and I don't mean to demean it as a simple problem, it's not a simple problem, but the answer is that in a situation like that, and the employer has certainly an obligation to its other employees to remedy the situation, and even though the employee may have a legitimate disability, that disability can interfere with the ability or opportunity of other employees to perform their task. It's analogous to the principle under the ADA, which basically states that a disability of an employee is not an excuse for misconduct, let's say, of the particular employee. In this case, we're not attributing misconduct to the employee, but we are attributing a deleterious effect on other employees. Okay. So, again,
so if the employee,
deal with
so
it
if the employee,
as an employer.
Just to be real quick, because I know we're on time schedule, so if the employee were to ask for reasonable accommodations to be remote and the employer denied him, then he could probably move forward with the case.
Maybe depends on what the operational. Yeah. It depends on what the operational impediment is to that employer. He may not even have the ability to remotely place that employee. But if he can, without significant expense or administrative problem, that's probably something that could be done.
Okay, that was just a quick one.
Any,
it was just the one off.
Sure.
Thank you.
Sure. Any other questions out there?
Howard, it's Jim Randisi. Does an employer have a right to have their own doctor sort of evaluate an employee who comes to them and says that they have a particular condition?
Well, again, that's the simplistic answer is yes, Jim, under certain conditions, either under the FMLA, the Family Medical Leave Act, or the ADA. So the employer may have the right to have the employee assessed for his fitness for duty, but there's some somebody might be on hold there. You can mute your phone. Jim, if you want to offline with me, Jim, the employer can do that.
Okay, that's fine. Thank you.
Okay, well, somebody's on hold, I know. All right, good. Any other questions? Okay. If not, I appreciate your participation. And as always, we will see you on the second Wednesday in March, which is March 13th. Anybody who's got any other issues can certainly contact me at hkerman@offitkerman.com or my phone number, 410-209-6417. Thanks, everybody. Have a good day.
Thank you, Howard.
Thank you, Howard.
Okay. Bye-bye. All right, bye-bye.
Thank you, Hal.